Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for January 28th, 2011. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, infants' awareness of social dominance, studying bird metabolism in wind tunnels, and we read from your letters to Science Magazine. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about carnivorous plants that eat bat dung from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
While physical size matters a lot in the animal kingdom, it doesn't matter much in most human societies, at least when it comes to social dominance. We bow or kneel or place superiors on thrones or pedestals to look up to them even if they are short and small. But when there's potential for conflict, we say we size someone up, in English anyway, to judge another's position within a social hierarchy or even to judge another's ability to do us harm. And now, researchers have shown that this relationship between size and social dominance is an understanding we all have, irrespective of culture. In a paper in this week's Science, Lotta Thompson and colleagues report that even before babies learn to talk, they associate bigger sizes with greater social dominance. Science's Sophia Kai has more.
Quickly recognizing friends, foes, superiors, peers, or even whether to lead or just follow, is critical for good social relations.
In a sense, one of the most important things that all infants and children have to learn is what their social world looks like, what the structure is like.
Lotta Thompson is a psychologist at the University of Copenhagen.
But paradoxically, to learn that, somehow they already have to know what the basic kinds of social relationships are.
So Thompson and her colleagues looked at whether babies can, even before they can talk, recognize that people can have conflicting goals. Then, if babies recognize that, the researchers wondered, how do babies predict who is going to win and so achieve their goal?
And what we've shown is that they use size as a cue to social dominance, so that if they see a big and a small guy having a fight, they expect the bigger guy to win.
But the trouble with doing this test on pre-verbal infants is that you can't just ask them what they expect to see. So instead, Thompson and her colleagues measured how long babies paid attention to two types of social dominance situations: expected, where the big guy wins over the little guy, and unexpected, when the little guy wins.
So something that is unexpected catches our attention. Infants, just like adults, if they see something that surprises them, they kind of, you know, glare and look longer.
In Thompson's experiment, the bigger guy and the smaller guy are cartoon characters, each with the goal of making it from one side of a video screen to the other. The conflict comes in because they are going in opposite directions and run into each other in the middle of the screen. The only way for one to get past the other is for one of them to bow down and get out of the way.
So what we did was that we made one cartoon where a big guy wins over a small guy, and we made one cartoon where a small guy wins over a big guy.
And babies looked longer at the screen when the bigger guy yielded to the smaller guy.
So the general idea is that you set up some outcome that either confirms or violates what you think infants expect. And if they're able to differentiate those outcomes, the only way they differ, the idea is in terms of their expectations.
We know from the last several decades of work in infant psychology.
Karen Wynn is a psychologist at Yale University who studies infant cognition and is not associated with the paper.
That babies tend to look longer at things that are unexpected or surprising to them than at events that unfold in an expected manner. And their results very nicely show, I think, that babies from 10 months of age onwards expect that it's the more natural course of action that a smaller individual would step aside to let a larger one pass by than the other way around.
And, Wynn says, they have this expectation even though most babies haven't faced this kind of social dominance interaction. That's because by 10 months, they haven't been crawling around much.
They're just starting to move about in the world on their own. You know, prior to being able to navigate around themselves, they can't be really engaging in tussles over who should get this toy and who shouldn't. So this is an age group that really hasn't had direct experience in jockeying for status and dominance in the social world. And I think that's one of the really interesting things about assessing their intuitions about status and dominance as disinterested observers who have not been really active in that realm themselves yet.
But study author Lotta Thompson says they're still not sure exactly what the babies find so unexpected.
In any given social scenario, there are so many cues that you could focus your attention on. So something has got to constrain the infants to look even in the right direction and be motivated to look in the right direction for them to even have a chance of learning our social world, precisely because the human social world is so complex.
And so even with this simple cartoon scenario of the big and little guys bumping into one another, Thompson says there are many things the babies could have focused on or expected. Thompson and her team were able to rule out, for example, that babies weren't focused on the greater amount of motion when the bigger guy moves out of the way. They also ruled out any expectation that the babies might have that small things are more likely to fall over than big things.
We've only shown here that they use relative size and that they associate. So they expect the bigger one to be the one that doesn't bow for the other one. So that's kind of like a, you know, a subordination posture also. And they expect the bigger one to be the one that does not yield in a conflict of goals.
Meaning that Thompson and her team have shown that pre-verbal babies use relative size to mentally represent differences in social dominance, but not whether they have any other ways of understanding social dominance. Again, psychologist Karen Nguyen.
There are many different ways of gaining status in society, and physical size is but one of them, and at least amongst the adult world, is often totally trumped by other things. Having a particular superior skills, being exceptionally intelligent, being particularly erudite, and being able to carry a crowd. And so I think a really exciting next step for this kind of research would be to look at whether babies are sensitive to other cues for social status.
And if they're not, when they learn them. For Science Magazine, I'm Sophia Kai.
You can read Thompson and colleagues' paper titled Big and Mighty, Pre-Verbal Infants Mentally Represent Social Dominance. Find it in this week's Science.
So this story is about how you get birds to work with you in wind tunnels. The problem is that not every bird is willing and able to fly in a wind tunnel. And that's the challenge for the researchers of the story that I wrote.
Science's Elizabeth Panisi reports in this week's issue on studying bird metabolism and flight in a wind tunnel that allows researchers to adjust temperature, humidity, and, for the first time, barometric pressure.
Researchers who want to study migrating birds have a problem in that the birds fly into an area, fuel up, and then take off again, and the researchers never see them. And so if they want to really learn about how, say, what those birds ate during that stopover affected how they flew, they can't do it unless they bring the birds inside and then test the birds in wind tunnels where the wind is blowing against the bird as it's flying. So it's basically flying in place. So one big question, for example, is how birds spread avian flu. And one line of thinking is that it's spread from one geographic region to another by migrating birds. But there is also some evidence that birds that are infected with a virus can't fly as far. And people who want to understand how an infection will spread across the globe need to understand, well, how far will a bird fly? And so one study hopes to look at what happens when you infect a bird, how much is its performance impaired?
To help with modeling the spread of influenza.
Right. So once you get these data, you can refine any models you have for predicting the spread of a disease. But studies of energetics of migration aren't the only kinds of studies that researchers do in wind tunnels. Several groups have tried to understand the aerodynamics of flapping wings. And what you do here is you set up a camera system and you fill the wind tunnel with fog droplets or oil droplets that can be visualized. And these things, basically, all you need is for the bird to fly a few seconds to get a whole lot of data on what happens when a wing flaps and it generates air currents behind it.
beyond filling the tunnel with fog or oil droplets, what flying conditions can the researchers create in wind tunnels?
So wind tunnels have become more and more sophisticated over time. They started out where they were just fans at the end of a tunnel. But at the University of Western Ontario in Canada, they have built a very newfangled wind tunnel where you can control the temperature, humidity, and also the atmospheric pressure. This makes it unique in that no other wind tunnel lets you control the atmospheric pressure. By controlling the atmospheric pressure, you can make it seem as if the bird is flying in high altitudes, and you can test the effect of high altitudes on migration.
Besides a wind tunnel, what other equipment goes into this newfangled bird facility?
So it's called the Advanced Facility for Avian Research. And what you need for wind tunnel studies and for any bird studies are good living conditions for the birds. And so this facility has special rooms for keeping the birds, including rooms that have little ponds in them. You also need special equipment, and they have a custom-built quantitative magnetic resonance scanner, which is used to measure body composition. When a bird flies in a tunnel for several hours, its amount of lean mass changes and the amount of fat mass changes, and the amount of water in its body changes. And with this scanner, you can just immobilize the birds in a plastic tube for a few minutes, put it in the scanner, and the scanner takes a measurement of fat and lean mass and water content and gives you a reading so you can test the bird right before and right after pretty easily, pretty non-invasively.
Is the government of Canada paying for all this?
The research facility was funded by a Canadian innovation grant to the tune of $9 million. So the Canadian government paid for the facility, the wind tunnel, and is providing some support for the projects for the next couple of years. But there are also projects supported by the National Science Foundation going on at the wind tunnel as well.
As you said, even with all the equipment, you still need birds willing to fly, and it sounds like not all birds do. Can researchers raise birds to fly, or are there characteristics that mean some birds will fly and some won't?
Well, researchers had thought that a key element was having the birds used to people. And so they thought what they needed to do was raise birds from when they first hatch to adulthood and then expose them to a training regimen by putting them in the wind tunnel, letting them fly for short periods, and then gradually increasing the amount of time the birds flew. But it turned out that for this one test with robins, the birds that were hand-raised really didn't do any better than the birds that they brought in from the field and just spent a couple of weeks with training them and getting them used to captivity. So now they don't bother to hand raise them. But what they like to say is that fat birds and calm birds fly. So it's very easy to make a bird fat. You just feed it a lot. Whether or not a bird is calm is another matter. Some birds are calm and willing to fly, no problem, and some birds aren't.
So you can fatten up a goose or a duck and it'll go into the wind tunnel, no problem?
Well, the wind tunnel is not big enough for a goose or a duck. It's only about a meter and a half wide and tall. So the birds have to be smaller than a goose or a duck.
Okay. So with all of that and the birds that the researchers have been able to study, what have they learned so far?
Well, one of the things they are learning is that migrating birds burn a lot of protein. And it seems that the protein that they burn is related to water use. What happens is as a bird flies, it becomes dehydrated. Once it becomes dehydrated, it needs to break down proteins in order to sort of produce more water to sustain itself. And experiments have shown that if you fly birds in high humid conditions, they burn less protein than if in low humid conditions. So it further confirms this idea that the burning of protein is important. Now, that protein comes from the muscles and the gut. And so they are basically destroying their muscles and their guts in order to keep flying.
What about fat and fat stores?
Okay, so the fat storage, that's basically what they fuel their flights on. So one question is how a bird's diet will affect its migration. And researchers have observed that birds will change what kinds of berries, for example, they eat, depending on how close they are to leaving. And so one researcher from the University of Rhode Island has been testing birds in the Western Ontario wind tunnel to see about the effects of polyunsaturated versus monounsaturated diets. So some migrating birds, for example, prefer to eat bayberry or viburnum, which are high in polyunsaturated fats. Polyunsaturated fats can be challenging to the system because the metabolism of those fats can create a lot of oxidative stress. So the question is, why do that? So this researcher from the University of Rhode Island caught more than 100 starlings and fed some of them a diet rich in canola oil, which is full of polyunsaturated fat. And then other birds he fed a diet rich in olive oil, which is a monounsaturated fat. And then he tested these different birds in a wind tunnel and evaluated how much energy they used while flying. And the reason is they're trying to find out if birds that eat diets high in polyunsaturated fats fly more efficiently. They don't have any results. They're still analyzing their data.
Is there any concern that the stress of captivity or being put in these flying conditions is skewing the results, at least for these metabolism studies or the studies about the stress of birds with infections like influenza?
I think it's something the researchers think about, but I think they're pretty confident that the birds get used to being handled, get used to flying. They're allowed to fly in the wind tunnel several times before they're actually tested. So I think they're pretty confident that if there is any skewing going on because of stress, that it's minimal. And for the studies where they just look at the aerodynamics of flight, they don't really have to worry if the bird's stressed because all they care about is whether the wing is moving up and down.
Okay. Elizabeth Panisi, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.
Science's Elizabeth Panisi reports in this week's issue on what researchers are learning about bird metabolism and flight in a specially designed wind tunnel and magnetic resonance imager. Now, David Graham, Science's online news editor, with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now, including a story about carnivorous plants that eat bat dung. That doesn't sound like a definition of carnivorous to me, Dave.
That's a really good point, Rob. You know, when we think of carnivorous plants, we think of plants like the Venus flytrap. This plant, it belongs to a different category. It's called the Raffles pitcher plant, and it's called the pitcher plant because it actually has these centimeters deep pitchers that come out of it that insects get trapped in these pitchers. They're attracted by bright colors and this really strong floral aroma, ultraviolet decorations. They fly towards the pitcher, they get stuck inside, and then they basically fall down into this digestive fluid at the bottom of the pitcher. The plant digests the insects and soaks up nutrients. And in this case, the Raffles pitcher plant has evolved this adaptation because the soil that it grows in is actually pretty nutrient poor, so it has to get its nutrients from other sources, in this case, insects. But what researchers found in this study is that although most of these Raffles pitcher plants make a good living eating insects, there are a few that are actually very bad at catching insects. About 20 or 30 years ago, a researcher who was studying these plants noticed that some of them had about 7 times fewer insects inside than others did. And he said, you know, these guys seem like they're really bad at catching insects. And when he looked closer at them, he noticed that these ones that were bad at catching insects also had a very narrow pitchers, and they lacked the scent and the flashy pattern seen in the other Raffles pitcher plants. But he didn't really give it too much more thought. He said, well, I guess there's just some of these plants that are not as well adapted as other ones to catch insects.
So what prompted the further study to look for another cause?
Well, it was really serendipity or happenstance. A couple of decades later, another researcher was looking at these same plants and he saw bats nesting inside of these pitchers. And he especially saw a lot of bats in the pitcher plants that the previous researcher had described as not being very good at catching insects. For some reason, bats had an affinity for these plants. They were sleeping inside these plants, and these plants were still doing pretty well, considering the fact that they were carnivores that weren't very good at being carnivores. So after that, this researcher and his team did some pretty intensive field work. They spent 7 weeks on daily pitcher patrols, looking at these plants, cataloging them, trying to figure out how many of them had bats in them. Sometimes he found bats sleeping with other bats in the pitchers. And he also attached mini radio transmitters to these bats. And he followed these bats around using the radio transmitters. And he found that they were really only sleeping in these Raffles pitcher plants that were not very good at catching insects.
So bats, while they were sleeping, are...
Well, Rob, they're basically using the plants as both a hotel and a restroom. The researchers found that the plants were actually feeding on the excrement of the bats, and the bats were probably going to the bathroom while they were sleeping or sometime during their stay in the plant pitchers. What the researchers did to find that out conclusively was they actually looked at the leaves that were right adjacent to these pitchers, and they found that these leaves have about 13% more nitrogen, which is a really essential nutrient for plants, than leaves that were farther away from these pitchers that the bats were nesting in. And what's more, the type of nitrogen was a type of nitrogen that's frequently found in carnivores. So that, along with the observations, really cinched for them this idea that these pitcher plants are living off of bat dung.
And it sounds like this has been going on for some time, if the pitcher plants seem to have evolved these different characteristics to be suitable for the bats.
Exactly.
Okay. So mystery solved. What other stories do you have for us this week?
Well, Rob, I have another mystery for you. This one is a medical mystery, and it has to do with the famous Polish composer Frederick Chopin. Now, Chopin died in 1849, and the cause of his death was the subject of a lot of scientific articles. That was a medical mystery in itself. Scientists had originally believed that he died of tuberculosis, or he was originally reported to have died of tuberculosis, but scientists sort of studying his case posthumously concluded that he probably fell victim to cystic fibrosis or liver disease. But there was something else going on with Chopin that was very interesting during his life. He was the victim of frequent hallucinations. He used to describe demons crawling out of his piano, and he also told friends often that he was surrounded by phantoms and that he could see the walking dead. These things that at the time people sort of passed off as, well, this guy is this really brilliant composer, and these composers, these artists tend to be very eccentric, and it was just sort of written off at that. But in this new study, our team of researchers takes a more detailed look at these accounts from the time, and they conclude that actually Chopin was probably suffering from a condition known as temporal lobe epilepsy.
Now, this is not at all associated then with the cause of his death.
Right. This has nothing to do with why he died. It's more about how he lived. And this is sort of an explanation for why he reported seeing all these bizarre hallucinations.
So it wasn't alcohol or drugs or...
Right. He
like
wasn't
that.
Reported as somebody who abused drugs or alcohol. So there had to be some other explanation. And there are different types of hallucinations. There can be auditory hallucinations, and hallucinations can be accompanied by problems such as vision problems and migraines. But Chopin didn't have any of that. He didn't have the auditory hallucinations. He didn't have eye problems or migraines, at least according to eyewitness accounts at the time. His hallucinations were purely visual. And if a patient were to come into a doctor's office today with those types of hallucinations, and absent all the other factors, a doctor would conclude probably that the patient had this temporal lobe epilepsy, which is how the researchers in this new study reached their diagnosis.
So obviously not completely conclusive then.
Well, not all experts are on board yet. Obviously, we can't talk to Chopin now and figure out exactly what's going on with him. We're really relying on these eyewitness accounts. But the authors of the study point out that even today, when doctors try to diagnose these types of neurological conditions, they often rely on eyewitness accounts too. So they're saying they're not at as much of a disadvantage as you would think studying somebody who died over 150 years ago.
Okay. So last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, sticking on the subject of neurology, this last story is about the science of self-control and how self-control or lack of it in childhood can have dramatic consequences for what we're like as adults.
What kind of consequences are we talking about here?
We're talking about everything from being in debt to having high blood pressure and sexually transmitted diseases, even being in jail. There's really a wide range of links this new study makes to an absence of self-control in childhood.
And positive things are associated then with people who have high levels of willpower and self-control?
Well, yeah, Rob, actually previous studies had shown that four-year-old children who could resist nibbling Oreo cookies, so a hallmark of self-control, went on to do better in school, and they scored higher on standardized tests. A lot of this stuff is fairly obvious. You would think if you have good self-control, then you're going to stay away from things that are dangerous and you're probably going to live perhaps a less risky lifestyle. And these studies had been done before. What's different about this new study is it's a lot bigger than these studies that have been done before. Usually they only dealt with a handful of children. In this new study, the researchers tracked 1,000 children from New Zealand, as well as 500 fraternal twins from Britain, trying to really tease out a lot of these confounding factors like socioeconomic status and IQ, things like that, really trying to get to the heart of this issue of self-control. Does self-control in childhood predict behaviors later in life? And they found very much the same results that these earlier studies have found, that these children that had good self-control in childhood went on to do relatively well compared to the children that didn't show good self-control. A lot of these children, by the time they were in their 30s, they were earning 20% less than the other children were as adults. They had more health problems like high blood pressure, weight problems, lung disease, and they were more likely to be dependent on tobacco, alcohol, or even harder drugs than a lot of these other adults who had shown more self-control as children.
So can anything be done then for parents out there who may think, oh, I've got a rather undisciplined child. I don't want this child to grow up and suffer all of these things. What can I do?
Well, the real big drawback of the study is it's just a correlation. It doesn't show causation. So the best the researchers can do is say children that don't have a lot of willpower seem to grow up to be adults that get into trouble either law-wise or health-wise, but they can't actually show that not having willpower is actually the cause of this. But one of the outside experts says that he is going to take a more active role in his kids' lifestyles. He has a 7-year-old and a 10-year-old, and he makes them play a game of waiting before they unwrap their candy for no other reason than just to teach them a bit of self-control. And he says it works. They do get more self-control, but it remains to be seen what they're going to be like as adults.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about the most distant object ever seen. And this is a galaxy that's 13.2 billion light years away. And also, researchers have just fully sequenced the orangutan genome, and it contains a number of surprises and a number of clues that also shed light on human and chimpanzee evolution. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got an analysis of President Obama's State of the Union address, which happened earlier this week, what the implications of what he said are for science and science funding over the next few years. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. Finally, today, we read from your letters to Science Magazine. Joining me is our letters editor, Jennifer Sills.
This month, we start with a letter in response to a September 17th letter by Donald Siegel and Philippe Bevay. In that letter, the authors urge researchers to fight to contain the current paper glut by publishing fewer, high-quality papers instead of salami-slicing their manuscripts in ever smaller, least publishable units. In response, Roberto Raffinetti of the University of South Carolina writes in that objective measures of quantity and quality of publications in science indicate that the best authors are usually the ones that publish the most.
Raffinetti argues, publishing one's lifetime work all at once would be of very limited use to the scientific community. It can be argued that the least publishable unit is a valuable scientific tool that facilitates data management, provides rapid dissemination of information, and stimulates integration of research efforts. Siegel and Bevay go on to argue that the paper glut is responsible for a perceived deluge of publications and consequently for our inability to keep up with the literature. Yet, half a century ago, Derek Price found that publications in progressive sciences develop exponentially and have been doing so since at least the early 1900s. This trend would indicate that scientists have felt overwhelmed by the scientific literature since long before the publish or perish policy took hold in the 1950s.
Rifinetti concludes, in the electronic age, the claim can be made that a manuscript is suitable for publication if it is technically sound, and that the importance of any particular article should be determined after publication by the readership. This is the claim made by PLOS ONE, whose explosive success in scientific publishing is an indication that the contemporary scientific community endorses the claim. With a vigorous peer review system, competent scientists can publish and will flourish. Incompetent scientists cannot publish and will perish. At the end, science wins.
You can read the full letter in the January 7th issue of Science. Our next letter is from the January 14th issue and is in response to a September 3rd education forum. In that education forum, George Boggs proposes that science curriculums at the community college level need to be reformed to include project or research-based experiences.
Igor Zaitsev at Borough of Manhattan Community College, part of the City University of New York, writes in to suggest that most community college students are not prepared to undertake such extracurricular research. In urban colleges, most students must work full or part-time, and many of them have involved personal lives. Few would have the time or flexibility to take advantage of the kind of programs Boggs proposes.
Since when has a lack of science research experience been an impediment to community college students expecting to transfer to a four-year college? Zaitsev asks. For that matter, when has their ultimate goal been to enroll in a four-year college? The goal of many community college students is to graduate with an associate's degree that might qualify them for professional jobs, often better compensated than those that require a bachelor's degree, such as dental and medical assistants, computer specialists, and engineering technicians.
Zaitsev concludes, what community college students do need is professional guidance to help them survive academically as they contend with personal and financial predicaments. Such support in community colleges is too often in short supply. Boggs makes but a single reference to improving student support services, along with tutoring for unprepared students. Additional funding for both, rather than the costly, hardly essential addition of project and research programs, is what community colleges really need.
You can read the full letter and Boggs's response in the January 14th issue of Science. Our final letter is from our January 21st issue and comes from Chris Kettle of ETH Zurich. This is a call, Kettle writes, to all those billionaires with a penchant for birds. Global biodiversity is dwindling fast, despite global efforts. Why not make a bid for these birds instead, so future generations might actually see some of them in flight?
Kettle is referring to the winning bid for James Audubon's Birds of America, which sold at a Sotheby's auction in December for £7.3 million. The Guardian reporting that price made it the most expensive book ever sold. Kettle writes, the book of life-size bird illustrations, painted between 1827 and 1838, is perhaps as rare as some of the birds Audubon himself illustrated. The critically endangered California condor, for example, now includes fewer than 200 birds in the wild. The £7.3 million in proceeds from the sale of Audubon's work would surely do a lot for bird conservation.
You can find the full letter in the January 21st issue of Science. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Rob.
Jennifer Sills is the letters editor of Science Magazine. And that wraps up the January 28th, 2011 Science Magazine podcast. We say farewell and thanks to Sophia Kai as she completes her internship here and starts work next month with the American Chemical Society. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.